Greetings, programs and users. It is time once again for another episode of Old Nerds Drinking. I am John Patrick, the Master Control Program.
Am I supposed to introduce myself? I am Rojan. This is the way. I'm sorry.
I am Rojan. Hear me roar. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing good. I'm like I said, I'm a little rusty behind the microphone, so, you know.
Well, it is Thursday night. We are old nerds, and we are drinking.
We are indeed drinking, and this is something that I'm... Have we talked about this yet on the show?
We have brought this up before, but Rojan has amazingly brought in a bottle of Detroit City Distillery's Punchki Day Vodka, Michigan and Polish potato vodka distilled with Hamtramck punchkis.
Have we explained how they made this stuff yet and what a punchki is?
So I don't know if we've done that. This is a local distillery right in downtown Detroit. I believe they're in Eastern Market. They have their own vodka distillery, and every year they make a punchki vodka. So literally what they do is they take punchkis, which, if you are not familiar, is the deliciously deep-fried, jelly-filled donuts that we all enjoy every Fat Tuesday, and they just cut up a bunch of the punchkis and throw them into a vat of vodka, let them absorb that wonderful deep-fried, and I believe these are strawberry or...
Are they strawberry or raspberry?
Raspberry.
Raspberry.
Raspberry filling. And just soak up that flavor, then they strain it all out, throw it in a bottle, and it is available only during Fat Tuesday season. So like the week before Fat Tuesday, they'll like make the or they'll deliver the shipments, and then it hits the stores. It usually sells out fast, so it was very, very fortunate that Rojan was able to find some this year.
I had to go downtown just about to the outskirts of where they make the stuff, and I found it. They have it around, they had it around here locally, but it was like about $30 a bottle. And then when I found this, it was like $38 a bottle, and they only had four left. And I'm like, let's just get it. Let me just get this. Now, for people who don't know, we may have explained this. Punchkis are a very fattening donut. They're made with eggs. They're made with lard. They're delicious. They're amazingly delicious. But they're kind of like a jelly filled or cream filled donut, for lack of a better term. But they're much richer. Like yeah. You can only eat a few of these things, or you'll turn into Wilford Brimley with
diabetes,
or your stomach is going to feel like you've got like five bricks in it.
Yeah, I am not a fan of the fruit flavored ones, but like they make custard filled ones.
Those are the bomb.
But there is one donut place in the area, Sugar Donuts. They make gourmet donuts, they say. Mm-hmm. They used to have one here in Wyandotte, but now they moved out to Riverview. They make a cannoli cream filled punchki. It is decadent beyond words. It is by far the richest, most sweet-filled, sugary thing.
Yeah, they are. They definitely are sugary. I like the raspberry. I like the strawberry and the custard. The raspberry ones are okay, but they're good with this. So yeah. You just want to get to drinking this, or?
Well, no, because I wanted to finish about the cannoli cream-filled one before I started coughing. Like, it reminds me of the Orlan. That little bird that's the French delicacy that you have to, like, eat it with a napkin over your head. Oh, you've never heard of this?
No.
Oh, yeah. This is 100%.
Well, you have to eat a bird with a napkin on your head?
So, I believe it's called...
Is this like eating a rotisserie chicken and getting grease all over your face? Or
they mention it in a movie, and I always thought it was a joke, and then it's come to find out it is a real thing. Anthony Bourdain talked about it. So, it's a French delicacy. It is the Orlan. It's this little tiny bird. And the way they cook it is they literally drowned the bird in brandy. Then they cook it. Then it's like the size of a sparrow.
This is something I would cover on my show.
Yeah.
This is weird.
So you basically just put the whole cooked bird in your mouth, bones and all, and eat it. But when you do it, you have to put a napkin over your head to cover your sin from God. Because it is considered so sinfully delicious that you have to hide your sin from God when you eat it. Now I remember where...
Okay, wait a minute. So if I put a napkin over my head, then God can't see my sins? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, of course, 100%.
I mean...
all right. It was mentioned in an episode of American Dad. Roger is watching the televised Barbra Streisand concert of Barbra Streisand singing songs of Celine Dion. And he wants to have an Orlin because it's the most sinfully delicious thing. So as a food, the birds are caught with nets set during their autumn migratory flight back to Australia. They are then kept in covered cages or boxes. The birds react to the dark by gorging themselves on grain, usually mullet seed, until they double their bulk. The birds are then thrown into a container of Armagnac, or basically cognac, which both drowns and marinates the bird. The bird is roasted for 8 minutes and then plucked. The consumer then places the bird feet first into their mouth while holding on to the bird's head. The orlaton is then eaten whole, with or without the head, and the consumer spits out the large bones. The traditional way French gourmands eat orlins is to cover their head and face with a large napkin or towel while consuming the bird. The purpose of this towel is debated. Some claim it is to retain the maximum aroma with flavor as they consume the entire birds at once. Others have stated tradition dictates that it is to shield from God's eyes the shame of such a decadent and disgraceful act.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to raise my hand.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm going to loop this back around again because what does this have to do with Munchkies? I mean, it's a great, entertainingly weird story, but
because I said that the cannoli cream-filled punchy is a decadent dish that is so sinfully delicious, you have to eat it with the napkin over your head to hide your sin from God.
Now I complete the circle. Now I can understand.
Wear it now.
All right, let's drink this shit.
Yeah. So I looked up a traditional Polish cheers, which I should know because I am mostly Polish. But it is still na zdrowia to life.
You're going to like this.
I definitely get the fruit.
It's not as punchy as the one that I had before.
I do get a little bit of...
It is smooth.
It is smooth, yeah. Like, there's no burn to it.
No, but this is not as punchy flavored as the one that I had before. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to hold that against them because the way that they're doing this crap, it's like,
yeah,
you know, you can't expect to get a consistent flavor every time. That, you know, in my mind, that's it's homemade. You know, it's a local, but still good though.
Oh yeah, it's still really good. And I get a little more of the like the raspberry kind of aftertaste to it. Like I can still taste that on my tongue. It's a gimmick thing. The hard part is going to be figuring out a cocktail to put this into.
Oh, I'm sure they're online. You can look them up.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I'm sure they are.
That's not the fun of being able to think it up
myself.
I'm actually
a little bummed by it because it doesn't have the rich punchy flavor that the one that I had before did. Mm-hmm. And I think I had it back in 2019, I believe, is when I had it. So it's been a few years the last time I had it. It is very good. I still like it.
Yeah.
It's just I wished that it had more of the punchy flavor that I was hoping, you know, would come through for you.
Let's see. On the back it says, every year Detroit City Distillery uses Michigan and Polish potato vodka to distill thousands of raspberry punchkis from Hamtramck's legendary New Palace Bakery. Our goal is to capture the camaraderie of the Punchki Day party in a bottle. This year, even the bottle itself comes from Poland. Na zdrowia.
Na zdrowia.
Na zdrowia. Now, I'm cheating a little because I'm double dipping. I also have myself over here, a Caucasian, because we don't call them white Russians anymore. Especially because I don't use a Russian vodka when I make them.
Do they make, oh my God, I'm having a stroke right now.
Man, if like every time
do
you
they make
said
a Ukrainian vodka?
Oh, you know what? I never looked to see if they make Ukrainian vodka. I actually use a,
call it a white Ukrainian.
I actually use an Icelandic vodka, but yeah, I found, cause we don't support Russia on this podcast, so I, for various mules and other beverages that require vodka, I endeavored to find something. man, I hate, I want to support local distilleries and like use local distillery vodka, but there is no fucking way I am paying $45 to $50 for a bottle of vodka.
I paid $40 for that one.
And I appreciate you, but I'm just going to say...
I mean, I'm not doing that to hold it over your head. I'm just saying, you know, good quality. But you'll pay that for a bottle of whiskey. You'll pay that for a bottle of bourbon.
See, that's the thing. I will pay that for a bottle of bourbon because I understand that bourbon has to be aged, which means they have to invest the money to sit on the product for at least 18 months while it's aging in barrels. So, yes, I understand that I'm going to have to pay a premium for that. Vodka, on the other hand, does not age. They make it, it goes in the bottles, it goes to the store. So I refuse to pay the same price for vodka that I pay for premium aged whiskey.
I don't know. You know, being a person that does distilling and has two stills and makes moonshine and makes mead and makes beer and all this stuff, it's just like everything else. You can buy crappy rum that tastes like rubbing alcohol, or you can buy good quality rum. And it's the amount of craftsmanship that goes into making these alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
And if it, like this doesn't, I don't mind that I paid that much money for this because it's very smooth. It does taste good.
And this is a limited time production
exactly.
thing. They only make it one time a year. So yeah, like this, I don't mind, but like the just everyday vodka, like that, Two James Distilleries, there's nothing that makes their vodka worth $50 a bottle.
No, it's like me and you were talking off the air about doing the whole Brita water purifier thing.
Yeah.
You get bottom shelf, like 5 o'clock gin or 5 o'clock vodka.
Run it through the charcoal filter.
Exactly. Run it, like even my moonshine, I'm going to run mine through a charcoal filter just to see if it gets the sharpness and stuff out of it.
Well, I mean, that's the old joke is like, what's the difference between a $20 bottle of vodka and a $50 bottle of vodka? And the answer is a $30 worth of bottle.
Well, the filtration and stuff too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's more to it than that. It's the base spirits that you're making it out of, how you distill it, how you filter it, how many times, you know, what kind of a still are you running it through, all that stuff. So I don't mind, you know, if it's a good quality product, I don't mind paying the money for it. Having said that, I can't bring myself to spend the kind of money on, because I'm not a bourbon drinker. I don't, mm-hmm. Everybody knows I use THC. I'm a gummy, edible marijuana guy. So my, excuse me, my need to drink isn't there anymore. I much prefer THC. So for me
honestly,
to look at expensive bourbon, a bottle of bourbon, I'm like, man, you know how many gummies I could buy for that? Or, you know.
You know, I have to say, like, I cap out at about $60 a bottle for bourbon. Like I will buy a $60 bottle of bourbon knowing that those are usually really quality bourbons that I'm going to only drink once in a while and really take my time to enjoy them. That being said, I, at a estate sale once, picked up a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue. Now, that is in-store, like, a $350 bottle of scotch. And I paid, like, $90 for it. And
I was going to say, you've got some expensive stuff here.
Yeah. That is something I would never pay full bottle price for. Like, seeing that, that was the estate sale score of a lifetime for me. And I made that bottle last. I took it to conventions and like was passing out shots to people. And I have to say that, holy crap, that was probably the best bottle of alcohol I ever drank. Like, it was smooth. Mm-hmm. It was flavorful. It wasn't like, I don't like a lot of scotches because they taste like you're either drinking charcoal or you're drinking bog water. And I can't deal with that.
One of these days, I really want to take you on the Bourbon Trail Tour down in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can do it all. You can do it in a day, but you really should do it in 2 days. And you'd go from distillery to distillery, and some of them have samples, and you can try, you know, all these different bourbons. And I'll be the designated driver that day because I'm not a huge bourbon drinker anyways. I respect the craft. I respect everything about it, but... And I know there's people out there that if they hear this, they're going to get pissed off at me, but I'm just not a big bourbon fan.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's got their own particular thing.
You know, but I respect it. I respect the amount of work that it takes to make them, how the barrels are made, how it's distilled, how the spirits are made.
Yeah. Thankfully, because I share the physique of the Majestic Walrus, I metabolize alcohol fairly well, and don't usually get too out of my cups.
Yeah, but after about 7 shots, you might not be feeling that way. I don't know. It's hard to say.
7 shots in a row.
In a row?
Right after each other. But if it's 7 shots over a whole day with water and food in between, yeah, I'm fine. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm going to get another shot of that vodka if you got some here.
I got a whole bottle.
I go through the same thing when people are trying, you know, marijuana edibles and I'm coaching them through, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, I can understand, you know, this is your first time. Well, yeah, give me, no, here's 5 milligrams, with 5, go from there.
Baby steps.
We're going to do this intelligent. And it's the same way I would imagine, like, if people were to go out drinking with me or whatever, I'd be like, try this, no, take your time, you know. Yeah. I'm all about responsibleness, so.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, there's the difference of I am drinking to achieve an altered state of consciousness, or I am drinking to have an enjoyment of the act of drinking. Drinking is in itself a social experience and has been for literally thousands of years. It was never something that was meant to be done alone. It was meant to be something done as groups, even back to like the earliest forms of beers and all that. It was still something you drank at a meal with people.
Or if you had bad water.
Well, it's not so much if you had bad water. It was just if you had water. I just finished a book about the history of drinking and like the history of alcohol. And yeah, there was a intelligent belief that water was poison.
Back then it was.
When
they didn't have, you know, purification and shit, you know, you didn't know, like, you could die of dysentery, you know?
When the Puritans came to America, people in England could not believe that they would drink water here, because in England, water was poison. You had to do something to it, or it was poison.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why everybody drank beer.
Or wine. See, wine, alcohol back then was viewed very differently. It wasn't, you drank wine. Everybody had a high tolerance back then too, though, because you had been drinking since you were a child.
It depended heavily on where you were and your social class. Wine was, if you were in Great Britain, wine was something for the elite. The basic people did not drink wine because wine had to be imported from France. There was no native wines grown in the UK. So it was a status symbol. If you lived in France, everybody drank wine. And then the rich people drank liqueurs and beers and distilleries or distilled spirits. The wine thing would come and go in favor. So it was like it started out with beer, like the proto beers that the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians made. And then wine was discovered by the Greeks and the Romans. Then wine became the rage.
Yeah, I could go on a big tangent about absinthe, too, but we'll save that for another time.
Well, absinthe doesn't come around until, like, the 1700s. So, I mean, you got a long history before you even get close to absinthe. So, after talking about that alcohol book I read, which I know you never have time to read, but if you ever do, it's a really interesting read. And it just really dives deep into like the back and forth of temperance versus intemperance movements, the various social and cultural implications of drinking, down to really even like how as the ABV of beer changes over time based on the needs of like what they're brewing with, the technology, and then like during times of war and all that when they had to change to ration. So just really, really like a deep dive into a lot of places. I love the fact that it's like you think about a history of alcohol book, everybody just thinks of Prohibition. And this book was 2/3 into the book before they start to talk to like the early temperance movements in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very long view history of alcohol. But anyways, the book I just finished reading is from MIT Press, which we've talked about several times about my discovery of MIT Press and just how it's destroyed both my budget and my free time.
Well, they do have a fantastic variety of interesting books on really interesting topics that you wouldn't expect to see, you know?
Yeah. I discovered them when I first learned about John Peterson and his fantastic books about the history of role-playing games. To find out, they have a whole section in their library of books on the history of games, both video and, board games. So this is one I found, and it is called Game After, A Cultural Study of Video Games Afterlife by Rayford Guinness. And I apologize if I'm saying his name wrong, but it is G-U-I-N-S. Guinness, maybe.
I would have went with Guinness, but
Guinness.
Who knows? I mean,
Mr. Rayford, I apologize. And that's not just the booze talking. Sober, I couldn't figure this out. I apologize. But this book is looking at video games from a perspective of what do they mean in a historical context? And what is a video game? So,
like, well, I would assume that's pretty obvious. It's a game that you're playing on a screen.
Okay. So is the screen the game?
No, the screen is just the method of projecting the game onto it, something that you're playing.
So what's the game?
Whatever is playing on the screen.
Right, but is it the cartridge? Is it the code? What is the video game?
What you're actually playing.
So
that's like saying, what is a board game? Is it the board that you're playing on? Is it the pieces of the game? Is it the dice that you're rolling? Is it the cards that you're picking up to tell you that you've gone into parkways?
And that is another, like, where I was going to go with this tangent, is, like, this is the idea of if we pursue... Video games are an undeniable part of our history now.
Mm-hmm.
They have affected our culture. It is something that should be preserved. But what are we preserving? Are we preserving the box the video game came in? Are we preserving the cartridge? Are we preserving the code? If you want to have a display in a museum about video games and you want to display a message about it, what are you displaying? Are you just displaying a screen capture of the game? Are you displaying like the box the game came in just in a static museum display? Even so far as, are you displaying a cabinet of a video game?
Ideally, I would think, well, ideally, yes. But as far as what a video game is, I would consider it what the actual game itself that you're playing is. It doesn't matter what the format is, because you have Pac-Man in the arcade, and then you also had Pac-Man on the Atari 2600. They're both the same game.
And they specifically talk about that in this game,
yeah,
that those are two incredibly different things.
But it's still the same game.
It isn't. It's they are two games that vaguely resemble each other, but they share nothing other than the name and the look. It's a different screen size. It's a different pixel limit. It's different coding. The characters move in a different way. It is not exact.
It's still the game, though.
But is it?
I would say yes.
Because,
like, Joust is the same as the was the same on the Atari 2600. Granted, the graphics were a little bit less, but it's still the same game. Hit the button, fly, move the guy around on the flying ostrich.
Yeah,
so get him off, you know, or asteroids. Asteroids the same way, you know.
Oh man, I don't know.
I'm pretty dead set on. I mean, you're more than welcome to argue with me, and I will welcome those arguments.
Oh, no. I'm talking about the fact that I think that vodka burned the back of my throat throwing that all back because I've just been. I got that.
That's why I'm sipping it.
I got that constant itch in the back of my throat that's causing me to cough all the time. But so yeah, this book is talking about that and like the idea of when if you want to display video games in a museum context, how are you displaying them and what is the message you want to get across displaying them? They use case studies of different museums and how they display the games. They talk about like, okay, in the Museum of Computing, you're going to display video games differently than the traveling exhibit that was at the National Museum of Modern Art that was talking about video games as an art form.
Well, then see that's a whole different kind of thing though, because then you're breaking the video game down, which is exactly what you're doing right now. If it were me and I were putting together a video game museum, I would try to have a cabinet of said game. I would try to have the cartridges, if possible, even the artwork. I would try to have as much stuff about the core game as possible. But the core game itself, I imagine, and like in the case of Pac-Man, would be to have ideally a Pac-Man full display cabinet video game.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, like it's because from there it steps down to, okay, now this is where the home consoles tried to imitate this video game. This is the game, you know, maybe an Atari 2600 cartridge,
because
and a television cartridge, a system.
Because it deals with a lot of things that you don't think about in museums, like the fact of, like, is when you see a dinosaur bone at a museum, you aren't seeing a dinosaur bone. You are seeing a plaster cast of a dinosaur bone because they don't display the original bones. They're too fragile and they're too mm-hmm. important. So if you have a display of an emulator that's playing Pac-Man, yes, it gives you the basic experience of playing Pac-Man, but it doesn't give you the exact experience of somebody who played Pac-Man on a 1983 Pac-Man arcade game in an arcade.
Hence why I would want to have the original arcade game there if possible. But again, I don't know if I would be able to let people play said game because it's an exhibit.
So that's the next thing they get into. The reason it talks about a video game afterlife is because these objects were made to be played in the home. And now we've reached the point where they're no longer in the home, that they're in their afterlife. And like, just into how do we preserve them? Like,
I've had thoughts like this. Mm-hmm. There's been many times, like when I was at Disney a few years ago, they used to have this arcade there in downtown Disney. And it was a pretty cool place, but I remember walking through there and they had a Tron video game there. And they also had the Disc Tron game where you stood inside of it. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I remember seeing both of those video games. And I had a lot of fond memories of pumping quarter after quarter into those video mm-hmm. games. And then when I played Tron constantly, and then when they came out with Disc Tron, where I was like, wow, this is really cool. You stand inside this thing, you got the, you know. And I remember, like, wow, this is really freaking neat. Another one was the Star Wars X-Wing fighter game.
Vector graphic one, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I remember seeing those games, and I'll still see them from time to time. Like, they had them in Vegas at a certain place or whatever. But I always remembered those, and I always had, like, there is a degree of respect and everything there because of the fondness. Like when I see, that's why I brought up Joust. When I see an original Joust video game or a Defender, or then afterwards they had Stargate, like that is something to me that should be preserved. And it's cool that I could walk up and I could play the game. And I'm like, this is, you know, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't as fun as I remember, but the nostalgia of playing that game.
So
remembering the fun times that I had playing it, that was what mattered to me.
So, a couple episodes ago when we were talking about lost media, like there is a whole history of lost video games.
Yeah, Williams, Bally.
Yeah, like of arcade games that in the first rush of arcade games in like the 78 to 83,
mm-hmm.
where they were just pumping out arcade games. And what's that? What's the Urban Legend video game?
I don't remember that one.
The one that they thought was like a CIA experiment.
Oh,
Plaxum.
Polybius.
Polybius.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I did a whole show about that.
Yeah. You did a whole show about Polybius, but like there are other games like that.
Yeah.
Where no examples of them survive.
And I remember a few of those games. I remember going to an arcade, and there was a lot of towards the end of it, there was a lot of startup companies. There was one where you had a guy that ran, and you spun the world around to make sure he wouldn't fall off of edges and stuff. It was a really cool, interesting concept. But I only saw that video game one time at a certain arcade, and I played it a few times on the weekends. And then after that, the arcade shut down, because with the rise of home entertainment video game systems, it kind of, and computer games, it kind of killed the whole arcade market. There is still some out there. There is still, there's still companies that make video games, obviously.
There are still companies that make video games. A lot of, and they talk about this, is that right now you have basically the only kind of video games that are being made anymore are like main cabinets.
Yeah.
Nobody is making video games that are just to be put in arcades, because arcades don't exist. What's happening now is you get places like Dave and Buster's and all that, where it's about tickets. It's about pumping quarters into a machine to get tickets to redeem for prizes.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're going to find a game like Gauntlet, where it's...
Red Warrior has shot the food, has killed the food, or whatever.
Red Warrior needs food badly. But yeah, the idea
Green Elf is about to die. I played that game in 30-plus years, and I still remember that.
Yeah. But video games that were there just to entertain you and play a game are kind of a lost thing.
Mm-hmm.
You still have, like, the racing games, because that's... a big draw. And I mean, there's still fighting games, but even the fighting games are made first for like computers, and then they just make a cabinet port of them.
Let me take you back. You might be a little too young to remember this. Maybe you're not. Do you remember Dragon Slayer, the cartoon video game? And then they had Space Ace was the follow-up.
Yeah, and it was that weird...
would blink and you had to move the joystick towards that part of the screen.
Yeah, it was an adventure game that was a cabinet. And that was actually one of, they were also very early computer games that you could play on a computer. And one of the things they talk about in this book is the fact of all the history of, like, arcade games. There are a very small amount of very dedicated people who are the master artisans that keep arcade games alive.
I've always wondered about that.
Because
like when I saw the games at Disney, I'm like, who maintains these 40-year-old video game machines?
Okay, so I don't know the one at Disney World.
Well, that one's gone now. That arcade's actually gone. But I've seen these games before, and I've thought to myself, and there's also, oddly enough, there's a few people I follow on TikTok that do restore these games or tell you how to get, because the other thing is the scarcity of parts for these things.
Yeah, so... in this book, the whole genesis of this was the author went to, like, it's the Video Arcade Superstore. It's in California. And this is a guy who his sole livelihood is restoring video games.
Mm-hmm.
And when Tron Legacy came out and Disney installed Flynn's Arcade in the California Disney World, this was the guy who basically was paid by Disney to install and service all these video games. But in his warehouse, like, he has just a warehouse full of parts. And the finite resource is cathode ray tubes. Because all those old video games use tube monitors, and they're extinct. Nobody in the world still makes cathode ray tubes.
Yeah.
So every time a video game dies, it is a finite resource that is being expended. But they also talk about what I mentioned earlier, the scarcity of games. Like, there's this one Space War game they talk about that was in a fiberglass, like red fiberglass flecked body. And there's only two known examples of it left in the world. And how do you preserve that? How do you get that across? How do we preserve playing that for future generations when there's only two examples and they will eventually break down? They are technological items and those parts and components will break.
At that point, you would have to recreate the code. This is, again, this is where the things where it's not so much... It's a cabinet. Yes, there's controls and stuff like that. But I guess my point would be, it's the video game is the code. It's not a matter of what's housing the game.
Mm-hmm.
I would think it would be the code. But however, you do still need to, when possible, pay lineage and respect to where the game came from if it's a cabinet game.
Like, one of the saddest things I found out reading this book is the fact that, you know, all the, like, graphics that would be on video game cabinets, like all the cool side art and all that, for the most part, nobody knows who made that artwork. It was designed in-house by the various companies, but there's no credits as to who did that artwork.
Mm-hmm. As soon as you say that, for whatever reason, the artwork on the side of the Centipede game pops
into my
head.
That's exactly the first one I thought of.
Yeah.
Like that super crazy Centipede artwork.
And followed by Space Invaders and then Galaga are the three that pop in, the ones that pop in my head.
Literally nobody knows. Because everybody who was involved in that is gone, and it was never something that anybody decided what, like, that was important to be preserved.
Yeah.
They talk about the artist who did the artwork for a lot of the early Atari boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably are old enough to remember this. Atari was a little before my time.
Yeah, I had Pong, and I remember getting an Atari, and I remember playing the Tank Wars game forever. And then I used to play, that's a cool thing about Atari. There were games on Atari that are classics that were never released in the arcade.
Yeah, because they were made specifically for the Atari.
I remember the Empire Strikes Back one where you flew around with the speeder trying to take out the AT-ATs that were walking. Everybody remembers E.T.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The E.T. video game. There's a chapter in there.
There was a whole chapter about the afterlife of E.T.
being buried in the desert, and then they found him.
Yeah, and he talks about that. He talks about going to, it's like Amalgalo, basically the city in New Mexico where they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just E.T. games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was an entire warehouse full of supposedly damaged components. And he interviewed somebody in town who was a kid then. And they pulled out, so it was like over a week of just semi-trucks coming and offloading stuff. And while they were offloading stuff, there was a couple of days where it was just getting ready to be taken to the pit.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys filled a U-Haul truck full of Atari 2600s, Atari video computer systems, like actual systems.
Yeah.
And then drove it to the Pasadena, California flea market and sold it all there.
I remember very clearly being young, and I remember the Atari 2600 for a while had its time, and then it turned into ColecoVision versus Atari, and then Intellivision came along, and that was into the system, and then Atari came out with they ended finally at the Atari 7800, which came out and died very quickly, and then they had ones like the 3DO and things like that.
The Atari Jaguar.
Jaguar. There was a Nintendo that you actually would have to look through. I can't remember what it's called right now.
The Virtual Boy.
That's what it was.
Oh, my God. Like, side tangent. I remember
that was 27 years ago?
Yeah, I remember the Virtual Boy, and when they had it at Myers and you could play it, like,
Southgate
my mind
Myers.
Being blown. And I shit you not, like, I have a saved search on eBay for Virtual Boys, and every once in a while, I get that itch.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man.
They only made a few games for it, and they were only, like, green. There was only, like, one color.
It was all red.
Yeah.
And, but I remember there was a Star Fox game for it, and, like, it blew my mind.
And then I remember when the Nintendo Entertainment System came along, and that was when I remember buying the Nintendo Entertainment System. And that was like when I finally got a real job and I was completely out of my own.
So funny.
I bought the Nintendo, and I remember playing that for hours. I didn't even have furniture yet. I had like a TV and a rug and I think a beanbag.
So here's a funny story. Do you know why it is called the Nintendo Entertainment System?
I used to, but I don't anymore.
So, that was after the home video game crash, when Atari went bankrupt and all the other companies were losing their mind, and Nintendo had made the Famicom in Japan, and it was huge, and when they wanted to import it, their American marketing people basically told them, you can't say video games. The video game market is so just destroyed right now. If you say video game, nobody's going to have any interest in it. So they came up with the term entertainment system to make it seem more like a VCR or something that would sit as part of your living room entertainment. And because it went the the technology upgrade to 8-bit graphics, like, that was the lightning in a bottle. It was, they hit, and it was like, okay, this is more...
I take that back. I bought a Super NES, but go ahead.
Yeah, so this is, finally, you have a home console that is the equal of an arcade game in graphics style. Because...
And for its time, it was.
It was. Well, that was the thing, is most stand-up video arcade games at the time were running more intensive graphics than you could do on a home system.
Mm-hmm.
And Nintendo was basically the first, I think in television, some of those were getting close, but that you could get the exact experience of a arcade game on a home TV.
Yeah, because Donkey Kong was lit. Yeah, wow, this is exact.
Like I said, Galaga was my jam.
Yeah.
So it's there's a lot of interesting places this book goes, and like talking about the preserving of video games, talking about like how do you preserve objects of video games? So like people who were instrumental at Atari and all these other companies donating their personal collections of like ephemera of release notes and memos, and like how do you preserve that for future generations for research for people who are current video game designers and want to know about that?
See, I think Nintendo has done a very good job of that, because they, being a Japanese company and how they approach things, like in America, it's disposable, make it, get it out there, blah, blah, next thing. Whereas by the time Nintendo came along, they were more along the lines of they knew that this stuff had to be preserved, because that was their thing. That's their culture. It's part of what their culture is. So there's a big thing on Netflix that talks about the whole Nintendo thing, and there's a few documentaries out there that are pretty good on it.
So one of the other things about this that I was fascinated about and was really interesting to me is there is a project in the United States right now, and it's called Preserving Virtual Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And this is it's a government-funded research grant or research collective, and it's talking about how do we preserve the virtual aspect of video games? Like, so there are arcade games that never got ported to video game computers.
Mm-hmm.
Those only run on the hardware for those boards.
Mm-hmm.
Those boards will just eventually disintegrate because of what they are.
Mm-hmm.
How do we preserve that? Basically that code. When the only way to play it is it only exports to a cathode ray tube. It doesn't have like USB connections. But more than that, so then the next step of that is, how do you preserve an MMO? How do you preserve World of Warcraft for another generation?
When... You know what? I don't think it's... Well, okay, one of the games that I love to play, and I still love to play it when I can, is City of Heroes.
Right.
So City of Heroes, that game died several, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago now.
Right.
Well, since the company went out of business, somebody came along and they still had the discs, they still had everything. But since the original servers were down, they went in and did an alteration to the code of the game and created their own servers. And then boom, the game more or less became public domain. So the game is still thriving, alive and well, but it's free. And it's still out there. They had City of Heroes and City of Villains, and you can still play both of them. But what they did is, once the game is no longer owned by a company, there's still a lot of people that play it. So what they did is they brought it back, but once the code became open, more or less open source, people went in and started creating their own power sets, their own costume sets.
Well, here's the thing. So like now at that point, you're altering what the original game was.
But the original one is still, they've made it a very solid point to be like, this is as the game was played. The only difference that, the only thing they've made altered was that in the game, this was back way back when the infancy of... you pay this price, you get this costume set, or you pay this and you get this edition. They've added those in there, and there was a kind of a struggle with that, from what I understand, probably mostly from where you're coming from now, is it's not technically the same game, but by the same point, there's nobody to pay to get this for the stuff now. So they said, all right, we just made it free. You can have it. It's part of the game now.
Because we're looking at...
So it is possible to preserve because the code is still new enough, not to cut you off, but the code is still new enough and the technology is still current enough where they can still make it work with the systems that we have now. It's actually very simple because they just evolved it with the technology as it goes. Mm. So preserving those games now, because we know the difference between now and then is back then when all of these Bally and Williams games and all these other systems were out, there was no thought of, well, we need to preserve this stuff. It was more, but nowadays it's different. Now there's an idea of, well,
because video games are more of a entrenched thing in our culture.
Exactly.
It's more of a cultural touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to one of the points the book's making is we have an idea of why we want to preserve video games.
Yeah.
Because we want to preserve the memory of them and the enjoyment of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a whole nother set of people who want to preserve video games for different reasons, who want to preserve them for their social impact, who want to preserve them for their technological impact. For the reason there are places that are preserving video games, one of the big places is a private collection called Supercade, and I believe it's in California or Washington. This is a private collection, I believe the largest private collection of video games, and the reason they're preserving them is as a reference collection for game designers, for people who are designing the next generation of video games, and they don't care as much about the play of it, they care about what went into making those games, and what about those games made them popular, and the problems that were solved to get those games out. Where we preserve, and that's the reason why it's important to preserve the originality of games. So, we preserve City of Heroes, and it's this altered code that people are making changes to, but we've lost all the iterative changes that were made from the 1.0. And if somebody is a game designer and they want to look about how those problems were solved, what we are playing of City of Heroes right now is not going to have the information that they need.
I'm not a computer guy, so somebody out there can smack me across the head if I'm wrong here, but I think it's all still the base code.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what happened with World of Warcraft, because World of Warcraft had advanced so far that people started going out and recreating the original servers to play online for free. And they were like, no, no, you can't do this. And there was such a kickback from it that they said, all right, we're going to relaunch World of Warcraft the way it originally was when it came out. And it was a massively huge success.
And on top of that, it also allowed them to retain intellectual property rights of the code.
Yeah, exactly.
'Cause that's another big thing is at what point do we recognize that what's more important is the company holding the intellectual property more important, or is it more important to historically preserve that information in a museum setting? Because it's like especially with World of Warcraft, how do you give a future generation were the same experience of World of Warcraft, because there's so many parts of it, because it's such a huge online world. Every interaction, every little village, every little instance, every little monster, and on top of that, the social interaction of people who played it. So,
see, the thing is, though, not to cut you off again, but this is nothing new. We've seen this before. We've seen it happen.
No, it is new. This is literally new. This is...
Well, no, I'm talking about the experience of the game. Before World of Warcraft, there was Ultima Online, and then there was the original Star Wars Online game as well.
Oh, no. I'm talking about, EverQuest.
Yeah, EverQuest was the next one I was going to say.
Going back to, the very early LAN games and all that.
So when it happened with Star Wars, I remember a lot of, I never played the Star Wars Online, the original one, but I remember a lot of people were like, it sucks now. Back in the day, you could become a Jedi, but you had to master all the classes, you had to do all this stuff. So becoming a Jedi was a big deal. And then when they changed it to where people could become a Jedi a lot easier, it all fell apart. But the other thing, Ultima, I remember Ultima Online, there was no there was no markets or anything like that. That game evolved where people just started setting up in certain areas, and markets became a thing. People created the markets.
Exactly.
You know, and like so that same thing happened in Star Wars.
So how do we preserve that part of it that was the human element?
You can't. Because
exactly.
Because that was the interaction that made the game. The same thing happens now. What's the one with the spaceships? I'm totally skipping my mind.
Oh, Star Citizen.
No, not Star Citizen. There's another one where you actually pay real money to build ships and stuff like that. And,
Eve
Online.
Oh, Eve Online.
Yeah, there was a big ordeal with that.
But there are books written to the history of Eve Online. Mm-hmm. I have them because I love reading about the history of
that
Eve.
You can't preserve. That's like preserving real history because it's a real virtual world that happens.
Yeah. So like that kind of thing fascinates me. But then I look at, when we preserve D&D, so let me talk about something, or let me before I go into the D&D preservation. What they talk about in this book is that a lot of information about video game history is preserved in online resources. And there is a misconception. We believe that once something is online, it's online forever. But it's not. The average website lasts less than 3 years. And when those websites go dark, I mean, there's the Wayback Machine we think about, but the Wayback Machine doesn't always save everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wayback Machine will only save things if you know how to find them.
Yeah.
If you have a link, you can go to the Wayback Machine.
It's like you trying to find that song that you
exactly.
had to do. Exactly.
Yeah. So we think about like, oh yeah, all this information's on the internet, it'll be there forever, but it's not. And so how do we get all of that information to a form that we can preserve for long-term storage and long-term accessibility?
Well, therein lies the problem, because digital data evolves over time. Yes,
exactly.
It is ultimately ones and zeros.
Right, but it's like, okay,
I've got tons
of old D&D or like old gaming material that I wrote, and it's saved on a 100 megabyte iOmega zip disk.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of electronic dance music and stuff, and I have an old school sampler at home, and in Sonic EPS 16 Plus, it uses double density double sided disks to store all of its information on. I can't get those disks anymore;
mm-hmm.
They're not made anymore. And on top of that, like I have to load the operating system into the sampler for it to function. And if I lose those disks, that keyboard is essentially done.
Every USB drive that anything is saved to is flash memory.
Mm-hmm.
Flash memory has a very finite read and write amount. Every time you do that, you are basically pulling one piece of paper off that will eventually, it's just never going to work again.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're going to need massive servers, but even then, how long, like a server 10 years from now is going to be different. So the only way you can do it is to take the information on the server and upgrade it to the new server, upgrade it to another server. You have to keep porting it over.
Believe it or not, they say the best option for long-term data storage is CD-ROM.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because as long as you have a reader that will read a CD-ROM, it's just etched in there ones and zeros, and because it's plastic, as long as it's not physically damaged, it will never biodegrade. It's there for all of eternity.
But you're already running into the problem now where most computers don't come with CD-ROMs anymore. You have to buy them. Fortunately,
they're
cheap,
separately.
But you have to plug them in with a USB. But
as long as you have, there's no, like, encryption on it. As
mm-hmm.
long as you have a way to point light at that disk and turn it, you will be able to read the ones and zeros on
it.
So it can be reversed engineered down the line. Even if we lose CD drives, we can still get that information off there.
But it's not the same as a book where 100 years from now, you'll still have a book.
Well, no, you won't.
It depends. It depends how the book's preserved and what they're printed on and all that kind of stuff.
The kinds of paper and all that.
There's still tomes out there and stuff. But
so now,
unless you're going to carve it into stone.
Even clay tablets, man. There are things carved in stone that are lost to time, but we have clay tablets from literally 6,000 years ago.
I mean, that's another thing. Like, you know, what's going to happen in 1,000 years where somebody finds your CD-ROM and, like, what is this? How do we interpret this language? Because computers might be speaking a different language at that point. So unless you've got some kind of a Rosetta Stone.
You're going to need Irving Finkel or that day's Irving Finkel, who is the guy who resurrected the world's or the oldest board game in history from reading Mesopotamian clay tablets.
I want to play that game.
I do kind of want
to. I want to play it.
He is a guy that I would absolutely love to interview. And he's getting on there in age, so.
I have noticed since, if I can, I would like to go into a small side tangent. I have noticed, I'm very much into Norse mythology and old mythologies and things like that. And I've noticed that there's been this big rebirth in North mythology and Viking history and stuff. And you're now starting to see a lot of these, and it's happening with Egyptian games too. These really old games are starting to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And, the last time I was over at Barnes and Noble, is it Barnes and Noble? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's still Barnes and Noble. That's like the last holdout of the book industry.
I mean, I love going there. I wish I could spend more money there, but I go in there and I'll see all these games that are like chess and all these other things. And I'm like, I want that old game. And I want that old game, kind of like what we're talking about right now. I want to go back. I want to play these old games that people used to play thousands of years ago, you know?
Post-tax return, I took a trip to Barnes & Noble, and that set me back $200.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Not in the least.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
So, but what the side tangent I was getting ready to go on was, okay, everything we've said about video games, now, does that relate to role-playing games?
Absolutely.
So it's like, okay, we can preserve the copies of the player's handbook and all that, but is that really D&D? Like, D&D was the experience of playing it, and how do we preserve that?
Like, that's simple. Here's the rule books, here's the dice, now sit and play Dungeons & Dragons.
But that creates a new experience. I'm talking about how do I preserve the old experience? How do we preserve our stories?
You can't. Like, those are individual. That's the thing about Dungeons and Dragons and these role-playing games.
You can. So, this is a story I'm pretty sure I've told on the podcast before. In 2000, when Wizards of the Coast bought TSR Lock, Stock, and Barrel, and came out with a new version of D&D 3.0. I went to Gen Con to get my copy, and it was one of the big to-dos was they invited Gary Gygax. Yeah. They invited Gary Gygax back to Gen Con for his first time in years. Cause after he had been shut out of the company and a couple of failed attempts to get back in, he was kind of just done with the gaming hobby. So it was a big deal that they had brought Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson back to be in the same room at the same time. Like, with everything that happened with D&D, those two people had pretty much become enemies.
Mm-hmm.
They hated each other.
Yeah. It's pretty ballsy to invite them together.
Right.
It's like celebrity deathmatch.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that when Wizards of the Coast shows up at your house with a dump truck full of money.
I don't know if I would, I don't know if I could do something like that. It's not even about the money.
Yeah.
Know?
So, but as I am standing in line to have my book autographed by Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, these kids come up and they're like, oh man, who's this line for? And we're like, oh, it's to get the autograph of Gary Gygax. And they're like, who's that?
And
immediately, get the fuck out of here, you Pokemon kids.
Well, no, but that is a learning opportunity. That is a teaching opportunity to be like, this is the reason you are here.
Yeah.
It all started here.
So, 20 years from now, if you show these new kids a copy of the player's handbook, are they going to even know what that is? Are they going to know how to get that experience out? Like,
yes.
D&D is... As much as D&D is the books, D&D is the experience of every person who played it. And we keep this gamer oral tradition alive, the way in olden times that stories were passed. Like, we all have those stories with our gaming group of that one time that epic thing happened. And those live on, and they're told at cons, and then stories that I've heard.
Yeah, but those stories are always going to be there. Like when I was a kid playing Dungeons and Dragons, I had no idea it was going to be what it is now.
But those...
And I'm glad it is, but my stories are my stories, and everybody has their own stories, and that's part of it. That's part of the experience of it. You know, like nobody, like everybody has the thing where they sit down with people that are, that have other played Dungeons and Dragons, and they all go into their, you know, story about how they're level 17, you know, kill, war, you know, fighter killed this whatever thing. And some of this, like my buddy I was with last week, he was going with this big, long, epic story. And sometimes you get bored of it, but at the same time, you know, you're like, this was their moment. This was their thing. That's why we play these games, to take us to in a world, to live these stories and to have fun. You can't preserve that. Those are things that are unique to each individual that are doing it.
Well,
you know?
It's, you can preserve it. And the argument
is
going
to matter as much to somebody else? It's your experience. It's your thing.
I argue that it's the most important thing to preserve. Like, the books will live on, but the books without the story are meaningless.
But that's
they're
the
just,
point of it.
They're just rules.
Yeah, but, the through game those rules it, that you create those experiences. So the rules, and I would argue that the rules in the books are more important, because that's what gives the people the means to create those experiences. That's the conversation I was having with my buddy. It was like, we were talking about people who, you know, and I this is no secret, I hate people who go out and you know, they create the super, they do mathematical stuff to create the most super powerful character in the game. And for me, that ruins it. It's like, I'm not here to create the most powerful creature in the game. You know, I'm here to have the experience of playing with my buddies and having fun. I'm not here to break the game. And my buddy goes, you know what you do in that situation? You say, congratulations, you've won. The game is over. You know, that's because it's not about winning the game. It's about having fun with your friends and living in that world.
And see, but that's the thing. Now, your idea on that is your
exactly.
idea. It isn't everybody's.
Exactly.
Like, for that guy who makes that character, that's how he gets his enjoyment from the game.
Yeah.
So, is his enjoyment any less invalid than your enjoyment?
It is if it brings down the enjoyment of everybody else playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
If you're playing the Dungeon Master and you've got a guy that makes a broken character because the rules allow you to make... Just because you can doesn't mean you should. You know, and it ruins the experience for everybody. Like, I was playing a game... The last time I played Dungeons & Dragons, I made a Tiefling Monk. And... There was somebody in the group that was like, why would you want to do that? Why don't you just make a warlock? That's what Tieflings are for. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to make this character with this unusual backstory. You know, I don't want to follow.
So I, one of the things, so, okay, I can't really say this because I've never actually watched Critical Role. But a lot of these, like, these YouTube channels.
Min-maxer, that's the term I'm looking for, but
yeah,
go ahead.
Munchkin Power Gamer, Min-maxer,
yeah,
whatever.
Power Gamer, but yeah.
What I love of the few of a lot of these, like, televised plays, I don't even know what to call them, but, like, the Critical Roles, where it's a group of people who are playing the game, what I love is that when I do see them, they are not portraying Min-max characters. Like, they are portraying... characters who are made for a story, to tell a story.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Now, I don't put that much work into my characters because I create the story of the character as I'm playing the game. Mm-hmm. And that's fine too. I this popped in my head. I would love to see a bunch of min-maxers and a min-max DM all get together and play a min-max game and just watch how that goes down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because everybody's had to be on their top game, you know.
There's
going to be people furiously flipping pages and books. No, 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 because this gives me a +4. Yeah, but this gives me a, you know.
And there was a joke magic item that made the rounds of the internet a while back, and it was the deck of many Tarrasques. So for those who don't know, the Tarrasque is basically the nope monster of D&D. It's basically Godzilla.
Yeah, I know. It's a big giant lizard thing.
Yes,
yeah.
You know that, but yeah. The listeners may not.
Yes.
And this is a magical deck of cards, and every card you draw just randomly generates Tarrasques of various situations. And so the min-max DM's like, okay, here's the deck of many Tarrasques, and the min-max player's like, aw, shit.
I remember, you'll remember this too, so don't cut me off, but I remember with Deadlands, a game
I remember.
Me and, me and you, remember Star Wars? But I remember way back in the old days of Deadlands, when that game was telling, that game told a story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. It had different time periods you could play in. But there was a thing in there, they always said right up until the quote-unquote end of the story of the game, you have the Reckoners, or the big bad guys of the game, like the gods of the game. And they specifically said, we never wanted to stat these things because we know that there's people out there. Once you stat something, we know that there's people that will figure out a way to beat these things. So they didn't want to do it till the very end of the game, to the end of the story of the game, to where they finally said, all right, now we're going to stat them. This is your chance for your characters to finally take them out.
And then the opposite of that is Palladium and Rifts, which gives you stats for everything just as a challenge. There is a particular monster that's basically Cthulhu. It's some kind of alien Rifts is a post-apocalyptic game that mashes up magic and robots and mecha, and it's just the Munchkin's paradise. No matter what you are, no matter how big and bad you make your character, there's something bigger and badder out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest, baddest thing in Rift's Earth is the Lord of the Deep, which is this giant Cthulhu monster that lives in the Marianas Trench, but has tentacles that are thousands of miles long. And in its stat block, because they give stats for it, they mention that if every nuclear missile in the entirety of Rift's Earth was fired at the Lord of the Deep, at the same time, there is a 50% chance it will kill it.
See, what's the point at that point, you know?
Yeah, like, at that point, they give stats for their gods in their pantheon, and it's like, at that point, it's just laying down the gauntlet of challenge.
But going back to what we were saying, you can't, I mean, you could preserve these stories, but the way you'd have to do it would be to write them out in like a book form. Like my friends that play, his wife keeps an amazing diary of everything that happens in the game. So it's kind of, when it's all done, they can go back and read it like it's a story. Oh. And I respect that they do that, but you know, how many people outside of that group are really going to appreciate that? You know, I'm not sure if I'd want to read it, but listening to them talk about the game that they'd been playing for all this time and all of these things that happened, they were very passionate about it. And that's one of the things I really admire, groups that play these games and stick together for long periods of time. That's one of that is the challenge. That is the true challenge.
Oh, yeah. Like, you'll see videos on YouTube or stuff that talk about like this one D&D campaign that has been playing continuously for like 40 years.
Yeah. You know, that stuff, that's mad respect, because trying to, like me and you trying to get together in game, you know, just playing a one-off game here and there is hard. It's really hard for us.
We played one game of Stargrave like a month and a half ago, and we've still been trying to play the second game.
And it's just hard. Life happens. So, you know, I would love to play Dungeons & Dragons or some kind of role-playing game again, but it's just hard because I got to work on Thursdays, or I need a babysitter on Friday, or I just started this new job. Like, I had a group that would meet together. We would meet together every other week, or every 3 weeks or whatever, but then one person moved away, another person had a kid. Life happens. But I go back to what I was saying before, is what's important is these rules, because it gives the ability for people to have these experiences, to have these games, and to do these things. As far as the experiences and stuff that they have, that's them. That's you know, that's the thing for them, you know, and that, you know, it's not so much preserving the stories that they have, it's preserving the ability for these people to do this and have these stories. Like, one of the things that I regret more, one of the big things that I regret in life, is when I had my kids, I was really looking forward to sitting down and gaming with my kids. I went out and bought 4th edition because it was a great, it sucked, 4th edition sucks, but as getting people into the game, this is what a role-playing game is, rules are simple. I went out and bought it, but I never had the opportunity to sit down with my kids and play Dungeons and Dragons with them, because they really would have loved it, and I would have loved doing it too. So, you know, but the fact is, you know, I've met kids, you know, I've met people come along. I've met kids that are like in their early 20s, and they're like, oh yeah, we only play Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And the reason they do is because they inherited the books from their parents. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like sit there and like a little tear forms. I'm like, God bless you. You know, I'm like, have you thought about playing, you know, 5.0? They're like, well, we don't need to. We have all of the books. We have all of the Advanced D&D books. We have the dice. We have everything. And I can't argue with them. It's like, you know what? If you've got the books and it's doing the job for you, and you're still having the fun and the experiences, like they have the original Player's Handbook, the Fiend Folio, Unearthed Arcana, and they're using them, and it's like, you know what? If that's what it is for you, do it. Have fun. Play your game. You know, that's, to me, that's more important. And again, like TSR a few years ago, not TSR, Wizards of the Coast, they came out, they re-released Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, as like an anniversary edition.
Yeah, and it sold good, you know?
Well, and those rules are basically open source. So now you have like the Osiric, the old school role-playing index and reference.
Mm-hmm. Marvel Superheroes. You sent me that big link one time with all of the Marvel Superheroes books.
Yeah, that's kind of a pirate thing. I don't think there's a legality involved with that because, you know, Marvel.
Yeah.
But
still, it's there. You know, you can get it and play it.
I just, in my idealized world, okay. Oh, this is a good this is a good callback. Irving Finkel, one of the projects he is a part of is something called the Journal Project.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a journal, you can send it to them, to him and these other historians, and they will preserve your journal. They will preserve it in a museum archive, as well as scanning it and make it available to people to read.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is there are generations of people who have life experiences that will be lost. And it can be anybody. All they ask is that you send it to them.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see that kind of research and compiling put together to people who have stories of their gaming groups, because I believe that the stories are worth saving. And it's, the rules are one thing, but the rules in a vacuum are,
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah.
I mean, the stories are important, but ultimately,
so like the whole, another callback, The Elusive Shift by John Peterson, Peterson. I still don't know how to say his name. But it's talking about how when D&D first came out, it was a miniature rule system. And they did not turn it into a role-playing game.
It was chainmail.
The community turned it into a role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
The way the community played it outside of the rules. So like in that, if we just look at chainmail, if we had just preserved chainmail, all we would have is a miniature combat rule system.
But it still is out there. You can still find it.
Right. But it was, the community made it something more, and then the game company rewrote the rules to feed the community.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe the stories and the community impact are important, and those are things that should be preserved. It's the Bowling Green Library of Pulp or Library of Pop Culture. Like they house a collection of like old gaming magazines and like the old gaming mailing lists when people just would mail newsletters before professional magazines were even published. So it's something I think about. It's something that keeps me up at night. And like,
I can't argue your viewpoints on it. I mean, I respect what you have to say, but it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. How do you preserve that? Is like with the video games, that is the challenge though. Like these, it's like you said, these old video games, you can't just plug something in and download the code.
So yeah, there was, one of literally the very first video games, was Tennis for Two.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, it was one of the nuclear research facilities had a open house because it was the 60s and like nuclear was something scary. So this lab had an open house and they invited families to come in and like they had projects and like graphics and talks to like basically just kind of make the people a little more ease. One of the scientists basically used a cathode ray oscilloscope and a homemade computer board to basically create Pong. It was like the same kind of, it's just a table tennis kind of thing. There's paddles, there's line. It is believed that this is the very first video game. But all that existed of it for the longest time was just a picture of the setup and the story of the guy who ran it. Mm-hmm. Because he built it for this open house, and then after the open house, all that equipment had to be redisassembled and put back to its original use in the nuclear lab. And now there is a computer historian who's trying to recreate it. The man who created it has since passed, so he's working off of his notes. And one of the first things they discovered is, in his notes, there is a wiring diagram of how they created this computer, and it's wrong. They built it that way, and it blew up the board, and it destroyed part of their things because he had made personal adjustments to it.
And never took the notations down.
Yeah. So they're trying to preserve this proto video game, and they're doing, like, he's trying to work on original, like, vacuum tube computer parts and having to scrounge the oscilloscopes to have it run, because the idea is not to recreate with modern technology. The idea is to recreate the object that only existed at this one point in history.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I mean, I respect it. I do. Yeah, it's cool.
Mad props to that guy.
Yeah.
I guess full circle is just, I think D&D and role-playing games have reached the cultural saturation point that video games did. And now that we're looking with an eye to video games, to how do we preserve these finite resources and these non-durable products. These are things that will just eventually sitting on a shelf. Corrosion will get to the boards. There's old cartridges that run on batteries. Those batteries will fail.
Realistically, if you want to break it down, that is the struggle of everything. How do you preserve old cars? How do you preserve these old books? How do you preserve these old photos? You know, at some point or another, you know, not saved will be lost.
Oh, man. I remember
which is what you do with the old video games. You tried to shut it off. It would say, anything not saved will be lost.
I remember web-based computer games, the old Flash games, that we used to play in the before times, and those are all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they may not even exist.
Yeah, because Flash isn't supported anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, there are video games I played online that may only exist in my memory. And I just think that maybe now we should be looking at role-playing games and how to preserve that the same way we're looking at preserving video games.
I think that's a little bit easier than video games.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit easier because, you know...
But the other thing is that role-playing games... they're still a thing, and they're still definitely, like, people who play Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of people still respect where it came from. Or else they wouldn't have re-released, like, the West End Star Wars game. They wouldn't have re-released Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. They wouldn't have re-released this stuff because, you know, there is a thirst for it and there is a respect for it to be there. Again, like I said, when I was playing Dungeons and Dragons when I was 12 years old, I had no idea it would still be around today.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that it is, you know? And it kind of looked like, I run into a kid and they're like, yeah, I've got this blah, blah, blah. And I'm kind of like, you know, a part of me wants to go, kid, I was playing Dungeons and Dragons when you were still, you know, a sperm, you know? But by the same token, I don't want to be a gatekeeper. I just want to go, you know what?
That is another whole nother tangent,
yeah.
Is the idea of like being a guardian of the history, but not being a gatekeeper of the
history.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's, I don't want to be a gatekeeper.
Like when these kids come out with like, oh, I watched Critical Role and I played like D&D 5th edition. Have you ever played it? I'm like, do not cite the deep magic to me, child. I was there when it was
written. But I don't want to be a dick about it either. I'm like, I was there in the beginning and stuff and, you know, all that stuff. But at the same time, it's like
kids playing D&D and not having miniatures. Fuck those kids. It was all about the minis.
See, back when we played, it really wasn't. We played D&D without minis.
original D&D, first Dungeons and Dragons, was. Like, it was only meant to be played with minis. So, you know, knowing your roots.
Yeah, exactly.
this is a little more of a highbrow episode.
I like highbrow episodes.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, it's nice to be able to like talk about this and not spend a whole episode just whatever media came out.
I like shows like this a lot, actually. Yeah. So,
but I think this is a good place to wrap it up. Yeah. Rojan, what do you have going on?
Right now, nothing, because my main computer that I record my show with, the graphics board blew out on it. Well, it still works, but not real well. So I'm going to get that together. Plus, I've just been on this podcasting hiatus for a while, you know. And I'm getting the itch to get going again. It's just a matter of, as far as my show goes, it's a matter of trying to figure out where I'm going to take it next, because for a long time it was paranormal, and now that I've been doing this for like 13 years, I've lost a lot of interest in those topics, but I'm still interested in weird and interesting, unique, different topics, and I've had a few things fall into my lap. I had a show set up to do. We were finally going to tackle the topic of Strange Elvis, and then the system died out on me. So now I've got some bills to pay off and stuff, but once that's done, I'm going to get the computer fired back up again.
There's a specific word, and I forget what it is, for when like an object or a person reaches a level of like adoration or like social conscience or just social zeitgeist that they are elevated to a mythic being.
Yeah, you see that with Elvis, Ronald Reagan, and there's a few people that are like that.
May he burn in the 9 eternal pits of hell.
You see that happen a lot with where after a certain point, people get elevated to a higher status. Whereas with the Elvis thing, we were going to talk about the Elvis UFO cult. Not Elvis never died. There was a lot of really strange, really quirky Elvis stuff out there, and that was where we were going to go with that. And we're still going to. It's just a matter of me getting the computer back up and running and stuff.
There's an urban fantasy series I read where Elvis is a demon and he sold his soul to the devil. So yeah, I find stuff like that fascinating.
That's kind of like, I'm trying to figure out the big problem with my show has been like, well, where am I going to take this now? What am I going to do with this? Where am I going to, what things am I going to, where am I going to take this idea of weirdness? Cause it was never entirely supposed to be a paranormal show. It was supposed to be a show about interesting, strange and weird topics. And a lot of paranormal falls into that, but that world doesn't hold a whole lot of interest for me anymore, but there are still a lot of really weird things out there and interesting things that I want to cover. But that's what I've been up to lately, is more or less just, getting that computer back together and really trying to like soul search where I want to take this beast next. So that's pretty much it, that work and all that kind of stuff.
And you can always find us at the Old Nerds Drinking Facebook group. Come for the podcast, stay for the means. But with that, I am John Patrick, the Master Control Program.
And I am Rojan of Project Archivist and Old Nerds Drinking. Peace out, folks.
End of line.
Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
German? Forget it, he's rolling.
It ain't over now.
So, what's the plan?
Take car, go to Mum's, kill Phil,
sorry,
grab Liz, go to the Winchester, have a nice cold pint, and wait for all this to blow over.
Might as well write them off.
Let's close up the bridge. Let's get out of here. Close it up, lights out.
Where are you headed, cowboy?
Nowhere special.
Nowhere special. I always wanted to go there.
We're going streaking! Yes!
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. Nothing to see here. Please.